Honigdachs, der Bitcoin-Podcast aus Leipzig.
Willkommen zum Honigdachs, Folge 68 und dieses Mal wieder mit einem Spezial, denn wir haben einen englischen Gast dieses Mal an Bord, Rusty Russell, seines Zeichens ursprünglich Linux-Entwickler und jetzt mittlerweile schon längere Zeit bei Bitcoin dabei. Aktuell kümmert er sich sehr viel um Lightning, arbeitet bei Blockstream. Und Stefan hatte einfach mal große Lust, ihn zu interviewen und anzufragen, ob er nicht ein paar Fragen beantworten will. Und Rusty hat sich einfach dazu geklinkt aus Australien. Im Folgenden gibt's nun also das Gespräch, an dem Stefan und Manuel teilgenommen haben. Wer nicht weiß, wer Rusty Russell ist, es gibt einen sehr interessanten TED-Talk, den er vor einiger Zeit gehalten hat. Den Link dazu findet ihr in den Shownotes. Wenn ihr diesen TED-Talk versteht, dann versteht ihr auch den Rest des Gesprächs. Ansonsten, es wird halt ein bisschen nerdiger als sonst, aber ja, so ist es nun mal im Honigdachs. Die nächste Folge, wo ich dann auch wieder regulär mit dabei bin, da versuche ich dann die anderen beiden ein bisschen in der Nerdigkeit zu bremsen. Aber ansonsten, viel Spaß bei dieser Folge.
So, this is a special occasion. We've only done this once before, Honigdachs in English, and we did it with Ricardo from South Africa. I'm sure you all know him. And now this time we picked someone who is even further away, who is, and that's Rusty Russell from Australia. Welcome towards Honigdachs.
Guten Tag. It's great to be here. Yes, as you say, it's probably about the furthest distance we can have away from each other. So hopefully the technology will hold up.
It's a miracle, right? And of course, we have Manuel here. That's the thing. Whenever we do English language podcast, which is only the second time now, it's just Manuel and me. I don't know. Somehow, Friedemann never has time.
So everyone email Friedemann about this.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, so we talked about doing this in German, but because you do speak German, actually.
Yes, speak is a little strong.
But, okay.
No inclination.
So. It sounds pretty good, actually.
Vielen Dank.
But we will not try to torture you too much here. Because it would be fun for the audience, though, wouldn't it?
World's shortest podcast, yeah.
Okay. Nah, we're not known for our terseness, but we're actually known for producing very few podcasts only. We're the deflationary podcast, very rare. And this one is even rarer, right? It's only the second one in history. But we have been doing this for about 6 years already, haven't we? It only exists. All right. So Rusty, I could tell the audience who you are. I mean, they probably know anyway. But maybe it's better if you just introduce yourself. What do you think? Why did we invite you?
What is your
pitch? That's a good question. Yeah, what was my pitch? So at the beginning of the year, I said, I've been too quiet. I need to appear in more podcasts. And so, you stuck your hand up and said, hey, you should be on my podcast. And I'm like, okay, yes, let's do that. So that's how I ended up here. So who am I? I guess that's like a fairly difficult question to answer. I guess I've been, I'm a programmer. I'm a hacker. I've worked on free software, free and open source software for... pretty much my entire career. So full time since 1997. Originally hacking on Linux. That's what I was best known for before switching across to working on Lightning. So that's kind of my rough backstory.
Right.
And yeah, so I like coding. I like making things work and making them work well. And that's what attracted me to this where I am now. Right. That's why I'm here.
You're at home. You're working from home, right?
Yes. Well, it's sort of 8 p.m. here, so I am at home.
Right. Nice.
So to make us all jealous, it's summer and nice and cozy outside in Australia.
It's actually quite warm. It was 32 today. It wasn't incredibly hot, but it was quite nice. So it's a little humid for my taste, but you know, I'm not complaining too much.
Yeah. We have a terrible winter here. It's really
awful here. It's the worst time of the
worst
year.
Weather you can imagine. It's just around 0 degrees, but no snow. It's all terrible. It's always wet. Blah. Yeah. All right. Okay. So you've been a Linux hacker. Are you still doing work on Linux today?
No. I was hacking for Linux professionally, like full time, for almost 20 years. And then I handed over my last maintainership. I kept doing it for about a year after I started working for Blockstream, just in case, you know, this whole startup thing blew up and I had to go find a day job again doing real work. But once that seemed like that had passed, I handed that across to a great maintainer. She took over hasn't looked back. And so I've really done very little. I haven't done any Linux kernel coding. Actually, that's not quite true. I looked at a couple of things because people have asked random questions. But you know, I really haven't. I'm completely out of the loop for the last 5 years on Linux kernel. It still works. I'm still running it. So that's good. They're obviously doing a great job.
It works on quite some devices today, I heard.
Yes. Even my camera worked eventually. So yeah, it is still a huge magnet for really skilled programmers of all kinds. So they don't have a problem with getting talent.
Wow.
And you know, if you are really good, you can get a full-time job. Almost.
That's very different than Bitcoin, I guess.
But the early days of Linux are a lot like Bitcoin today, right? There were a whole heap of questions. In fact, Bitcoin today reminds me a lot of those early Linux days, right? And that's why I think I find it so appealing. So Linux was a poster child for open source and free software, and everyone was. I went through this epiphany with Linux, right? So I'd used Linux on a couple of my machines and things, but I was a Unix person. I was using Solaris and Sun machine, big Sun machines, whatever. There was a conference in the US called Usenix. It was the big Unix conference. And they had a Linux track, so they invited some Linux hackers along to talk about, you know, Linus Torvalds and a whole heap of other, in fact, almost all the top Linux contributors, most of whom were students at the time. And this is sort of 97. So Linux is like 6 years old. It's kind of interesting. And I thought, that's cool. I should definitely go. I've heard of this legendary conference and there's the Linux things. So that'll be cool. And there was a shift between the time I went into that conference and the time I came out. And when I went in, I had this worldview that I think was common that everyone had at the time, that the way you made an operating system, like a, you know, that runs on your computer, makes everything work is, you know, you have a large corporation, they hire programmers, they work for years, they're all this, the systems that same thing. The idea that you could have like this bunch of random people on the internet, produce an operating system that was anything other than a joke that could actually work was not in the worldview. That's not how you made software. That just simply wasn't how it was done, right? That we knew how to make software and that's not it. But I went to some talks and particularly one talk by David Miller on the Boarding to the UltraSpark that completely blew my mind. And I realized two things. The first thing I realized is this is what I wanted to do. I left that and I was like, I want to work with these people because they are doing the most awesome stuff. The excitement. I have to do this. And so I did. But the other thing that made me realize slowly was that there was a new way of making software, and it seemed to be even better than the old way. And it was a really weird idea that we could get random people from the internet to make your software and it would actually work. Like it would actually do something. And that was just, it's hard to imagine how much of a shift that was. So a lot of other, so while Linux was the poster child for open source and free software, there were a lot of other projects that came out doing this, and you know, and we'd hear about them, I'd play with them. And one of them was Bitcoin, right? And Bitcoin was trying to do the same thing, right? And everyone knows how you make currency, right? You do not get a bunch of randos on the internet to run software on their computer and make currency. That's just not how it works, right? That's stupid, right? That's not how you make a currency. So there were a lot of parallels between the early dismissals from what everyone knew of how to build something in the Linux and Bitcoin worlds. And so I think because I'd made that mistake once, the second time around, I had, I think, a bit of an insight into how this could actually work.
Oh, so you weren't skeptical. You weren't as skeptical when you first encountered it then.
So when I first encountered Bitcoin, it wasn't really a currency, right? It was another open source project trying to do something weird. Like there's a lot of open source projects trying to do something weird.
When are we talking?
Like, you know, sort of 2011 kind of time frame, right? So it's still pretty early. It's when I first encountered it and I read the white paper and I thought, oh, that's kind of a cool idea. I like what they're doing. And they're just a bunch of hackers
like
trying to make an online currency. I'm like, that's cool, you know? Mm-hmm. And I played with it a bit. I bought some Bitcoin and I spent it on, I got shoes from Tehran.
did you get the socks? The socks, yeah.
The socks? I did not get the socks.
I did. I got them.
Oh, you did the socks. Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, same kind of thing. You know, playing around with his money. But I never, you know, I got some money just to play with it. So I pretty much spent it all. Except a little bit. There's a funny aside. I got married and my wife said, oh, you know, the Bitcoin price went up to like, you know, like $200 or something. And she said, huh, well, half of that money's mine. I'm like, okay, I guess so, right?
Sounds
so
familiar.
I'd spent my half, right? So I took the other half and I sent it to Matt Cox, right? You know, like, ooh, largest exchange in the world. I sold it and I wired the money home. And the money's not coming. The money's not coming. And, the money's still not coming. What's happening? And so I used the money to then buy some Bitcoin back again, and then Bitcoin, you know, it all collapsed. Now that turned out to be a really good move because I actually owe a small fraction of Bitcoin from the Mt. Gox settlement. So after we all retire and the Mt. Gox settlement finally comes through,
That's
right. Even though you take a huge haircut, I was trying to sell it anyway, right? So even if
then you actually won.
I won. I was pretty annoyed at the time, and you know, I had to apologize to my wife. I'm like, sorry, I did this thing where I lost all your Bitcoin, lost all the money. So there is that. So there's potentially a silver lining. But yeah, so that was kind of my Bitcoin story. I came at it from a technology side, so I never really. So it was pretty clear to me. It was an easy story. Like they're trying to do something interesting. It's an open source project. It's cool. And that was my introduction.
Ooh.
Looking back, both of these projects really sound insane and unheard of and unimaginable.
Yeah, but this is an important lesson, right? So firstly, we knew what we were doing with Linux, right? We were going to beat Microsoft. Everyone working on Linux was like, no, this is, we're going to produce an operating system that competes with Windows. That was exactly what we knew what we were doing, right? And it was going to be the year of the Linux desktop every year, right? And we were so wrong about that one, right? We produced something amazing, but that wasn't it. So that's an important lesson. You can think you know where you're going, but you actually go somewhere else. But the second thing is that if you produce something that's useful and interesting, it will have interesting effects. And one of the main criticisms of Linux early on was, who am I going to get to support this? How can I trust random people on the internet to write mission critical code for me? Right? I need this to work. Who do I sue if, you know, whatever, right? And we never got a good answer for that, right? We still don't have a good answer. How can you trust randoms on the internet? Actually, it turns out you can't, right? It's actually a really hard problem. It didn't matter because two things happened. One is that people who were like, I'm never trusting code on the internet, retired or died or whatever, you know, they grew old, and new people who were for whom Linux had always been there became CIOs of operations and everything else, and they had no problems with trusting the software that had always worked for them. And the second thing is that it was useful. Mm-hmm. And it was so useful that eventually, even though we never had good answers to these questions, people learned to live with it. So, you know, Bitcoin may never have answers to this what if, what about volatility and other things. But if it's useful enough, and as you get, you know, natural maturity, there are people who grew up and it's always been there. They have a very different approach to it than somebody who went through the transition from Bitcoin being not a thing to it becoming a money, right? It will never be money to them in the same way that it is to somebody for whom it always has been.
That's great. These are some great points, actually. I mean, with Linux, because you said we don't have good answers for how do you trust random people making changes. That's very similar in Bitcoin, actually. Yeah, because we have all these, you know, there are all these theoretical attacks that people could do, right, on Bitcoin, and we don't have good answers for that. And has it never occurred in Linux that someone introduced some malevolent code in there?
Oh, but these things happened.
Well, not really. Part of the problem is the illusion that happened before, because and this is very similar to the whole question of like, what is money? Software was something that people produced and they shipped it to you and it all, you know, that was it. Nobody thought about there's a company, there's people behind that making decisions without transparency, right? They're just,
you're right.
They decide what goes in, what goes out, what bugs to ship with, what to fix, and they send it to you. And if you don't understand things very well, you go, oh, well, you know, that's great. They do all that work for me. Must be perfect. Mm. It must be perfect behind there. And in Linux, I can see everything that's happening. And I can see, you know, Linux have a drag out fight with one of the maintainers over some feature, right? And, you know, it's much more transparent. And that, if you don't know very much, can be quite disturbing. But as you get more experienced or as you get used to it, you start to go, actually, I don't trust the other way at all, because
it's actually much safer.
I don't have any idea. And certainly people in the industry, so, you know, I'm a professional programmer, I am aware how bad code is on average, particularly proprietary code where there's only a few people to look at it. It is shocking that it works at all. I can't remember who it was who said that if computer programmers built buildings, the first woodpecker that came along would destroy society. And it is very true. Standards are incredibly low across the industry, and it's, you know, and transparency is only one of the things that helps us. So, and this was part of the thing. It worked. It worked remarkably well. But it wasn't immediately obvious, if you hadn't thought about it, why it would work well. Right. We didn't really know what we were missing until we had it. We were like, oh, so you work on this in the open and people can see the technical decisions that go in. A much broader number of people can see. No, you don't have to be inside Microsoft to know how your operating system works. And that turned out to be really important. But, you know, we're looking backwards at that, right? It wasn't obvious to me going in.
I think the more I think about it, I like this analogy more and more. Like, I suppose in the beginning, developers were expecting Linux will take over the desktop and Windows 98 or whatever will be overrun by Linux, but it's the other way around. And the desktop is, I don't know, probably 80-90% it's still Windows, but all the mission critical servers and all the infrastructure runs Linux.
Yeah.
And maybe there's a lesson for Bitcoin here.
Yeah. All 500, top 500 supercomputers now run Linux. And that was not what we were trying to do, right? And nobody, Linux was never in like 91 or even like 96. Nobody was going, what we really need is, you know, this is going to run on supercomputers. That was never a target. Somebody went and did it. And that permissionless innovation is really important, right? This, you put it out there. What if people do terrible things with it? But what if they also do great things with it? People did things with Linux that, so in some cases with my code, that was amazing. I never would have thought of it. It's not that I technically maybe couldn't have done it, but I never would have tried. In some cases, like, I just didn't have the skills in whatever area. But maybe I could have done it, but I would never have thought of that, right, in a million years. There's people going out there and just taking your stuff and doing it. And they never came back for asked for permission or anything else. You looked in and you went, oh, wow, they're using my code. That's kind of cool. So that permissionless nature is very much the Bitcoin and certainly the Lightning story, right? I'm building Lightning like at the low level, and people are going and building all kinds of things. And a lot of them are dumb, and you know, some of them won't work, and some of them certainly be done better. But there's a whole pile of ideas that I would never have done that, right? And I think the first killer app will probably be something that I'll go, that is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And I will be wrong. I'll be so wrong, right? It'll catch on. I'll be like, okay, well, I didn't get it, right? You know, it's not how my mind works. And it turns out that was the coolest thing ever. And everyone wanted it, right? So I've learned not to, to have humility trying to predict the future. Even when you're certain, the future has a way of surprising you.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think we all have been there and been surprised by what strange, weird stuff catches on, especially in the crypto scene or in Bitcoin.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah, like, you know, for example, I now know where El Salvador is.
Neither of us did, I guess.
That's, yeah, no. Yeah. I would not have predicted that.
That's really funny. So maybe that's a good point of that's a good place for posing the question is what is Bitcoin today for you? Do you even have a model? Is there something? What is important about it for you now? Or do you say I don't care? I just make it better, and other people are to decide whatever they do.
No, I think I do care. I think. We're in this window where Bitcoin isn't important enough that we still can't fix it, right? We can still make tweaks and we can still improve it and everything else. At some point, I think Bitcoin will become too important for anyone to touch, right? And it will ossify, it will fossilize, and we'll be stuck with whatever state that is. So this is an important area where you want, you know, really careful thought about what changes we can make, because we're stuck with them forever. You really can't remove a rule. You can't say, oh, we're no longer allowing that. It was a dumb idea. You're stuck with it forever in Bitcoin. So you kind of got to choose. And that, and to choose wisely, all you need to do is predict the future accurately.
That's easy.
So you do the best you can. And, you know, with a certain amount of awareness, like there's this pressure on you to get it right. And I think generally, like, the Bitcoin devs have done a really good job of trying to juggle that. I mean, you know, I can look back at some of the previous technical decisions and go, well, that was dumb. But, you know, we are getting better. And we're in this unique window. I think I can't see us changing Bitcoin much in 20 years. I think we've got this window where we get to kind of tweak it and improve it. But it's going to get harder and harder to change. So I do care, even just from a technical perspective. And I always say this about Linux. Like, I don't care if no one else uses Linux. You know, so I always said to my fellow hackers, I don't like you all that much, right? You know, but to be fair, right? No person is an island. I couldn't just use it by myself, because then I'd have to write all my own device drivers. I have to port all my own. So, you know, that was never going to work, right? So you do need a critical mass of people. But as long as enough people use it, as long as I had all the things that I needed, yeah, whatever, right? And so as long as, and mine's similar, right? As long as Bitcoin's big enough that I can use it usefully and it does all the useful things for me. So as long as, from the Linux point of view, as long as enough people used it, I was happy, right? As long as we had that ecosystem right. That could support me, right? And what I want. And Bitcoin is the same. As long as there is enough stuff for me, that's great. And anything beyond that is a bonus. Like, that's great. So from a technical perspective, I need enough people using Bitcoin that I can do the things I want with it. Now, we're probably pretty close to that size now, to be honest. But here's the thing. I want to work with really smart people doing really cool stuff. And so we need to find them. And I want them to come in and join me, right? And you know, I want people smarter than me working on Bitcoin. A lot of them already are. But there's a lot more smart people out there who are not here yet. Right. And I really wish they were. So if there's any one thing I want in growth, it's growth from people who I want to work with, who are brighter than I am, which is a really good way to segue across to my shit Bitcoiners say Twitter account, actually.
Yes. So you don't need me at all.
Well, so I have my normal Twitter account, Rusty Twit, where I tweet about, you know, stuff that I'm working on and things that are related to that. But I also have another Twitter account, which is my mocking other Bitcoiners Twitter account, which really is aimed at the kind of irrational exuberance, right? So that people who are like, you know, Bitcoin's going to make unicorns fart rainbows, and you know it will, you know.
That's Ethereum, though.
Yeah, there are Bitcoiners who are very much like, you know, buy today, get rich tomorrow. How many Lambos are you going to drive? And everything on the spectrum of like, you know, the coin fixes this kind of
model. It's going to end wars.
It will end wars. You know, it will be impossible to it will be impossible to dislike anyone under a Bitcoin standard. Yeah. So I do that partially for entertainment value, but a lot of it is also because who do you want to attract to Bitcoin? I don't really want to attract more boosters, more people who are just thoughtlessly repeating this mantra of, you know, Bitcoin fixes this or Bitcoin solves wars or anything else. I really want to attract people who are thoughtful, right? Who are thinking really hard about the problems and the solutions. So as an engineer, everything's in terms of problems, right? You don't worry about things that are already solved. In order to, the things that Bitcoin does well don't worry you so much. You're more worried about things that could go wrong, things that we don't have good answers for yet, and those kind of things. And you know, it can seem kind of negative sometimes, but that's just the engineering mindset, right? You don't worry about things that are not problems. So I want to attract more of those people. And so I think having an account which is a little bit more down to earth and a little bit more relatable for people who have that mindset, maybe attracts people who don't come into the Bitcoin, they go into Bitcoin Twitter or something and they go, oh my God, this is like a cult, right?
it is.
It really would have been unbearable to read these tweets without your comments.
Thank you. Well, I hope you have sympathy for me because I have to read them so that I can, so that I can respond to them. Although I do have a number of good contributors who tag me on when they find something. That
oh, nice! Yeah,
very helpful. And please keep doing that. You know who you are.
That's. I love this account. I mean, it's also just plain funny. It's just amazing. If you give some things the right context, right? It's just amazing. If I don't know,
I certainly recently got to retweet Peter Wooler,
and that was the high point.
He has a great sense of humor. He took it very well. He said he deserved it, which he did not, by the way. But it was very nice of him to say that. There's certainly an amount of fun to be had with that account. I've retweeted my real tweets across there too. I think I perhaps, you know, could be interpreted in a hyperbolic way.
So you're saying shit too.
It is really hard to avoid though, right?
That's true.
I am incredibly optimistic and passionate about the future of Lightning, and I think there's some amazing things, but it's kind of easy to, you know, take something out of context and go, wow, that really sounds like you're a cult leader at that point, right? Lightning fixes this. We're going to, you know, end wars or, you know, shorten their duration because you can only pay small amounts for them or something. I don't know. I'm not sure what our policy is for Lightning, but yeah, all of us can fall into this trap. So it is useful to have a little voice in my head saying, Rusty, you're going to have to retweet that from your other account if you say that. So tone it down.
Tone it's very it useful down. Frame. Yeah, I think that's great. Maybe I can steal that somehow. Because I always find it's hard, you know, if to be skeptical in this space is a really hard position, I find. I do this a lot with carbon stuff, yeah, climate change stuff. We have this initiative called netpositive.money. And it's really tough because you get attacked from both sides. You get from one side, they just see me as a greenwashing guy.
Yeah.
And the Bitcoiner side see me as a communist. So it's and so it's hard, you know. and of course I catch myself saying positive things. It's downplaying the problem, and then probably I need an account that says, okay, you know, shit Bitcoin greenwashers say.
It is useful. It does give you some perspective of you know how the other half live. But you know, I It's also good. When I'm tired, I don't have much brain space left. It's an easy account to run, right? You just click on something, you go, okay, that was stupid. Retweet. done. And there's a lot. There's a lot to choose from. Your problem is mainly target selection.
That's true.
So, yeah.
So when you said that you see a time frame where we can change serious things in Bitcoin, like maybe 20 years, do you have something on top of your mind what you need to see changed in this time frame? Like bigger things, Bitcoin itself?
That's a really good question. So there are three general areas, right? Four. There are sort of just janitorial cleanups that would be nice. I don't think they're worthwhile. Not by themselves. If we're doing something else as well, then maybe doing them. And janitorial in this case means a hard fork, right? So if we're going to do a hard fork, there are some things we could clean up that we can't get rid of without breaking backwards compatibility. So a hard fork obviously means that it's something we haven't had really in Bitcoin before, which is where we'd have to get everyone to upgrade, and old clients would fall off the network. We've never done that before. But if we did have to do it, then it might be an opportunity to do some cleanups. There's cryptographic changes. So there are cool new crypto happening all the time. If some of them crosses a point where everyone's comfortable with it, there are something with zero knowledge, hand wave or confidential amounts or other things that could enhance Bitcoin that would be possible at some point. They're not practical today, but as things develop, it's possible. There are things that are going on. So squeezing more things, doing more with less, right? Compressing more stuff into our blocks is the current Bitcoin technology focus, pretty much. SegWit did some of it. Taproot does a lot more of it. There's cross-input signature aggregation and other ideas to basically try to get more for less, right? If we can make transactions smaller in some way or more compact, can represent more things with less bytes, that's an easy win. So there'll be a lot of those kind of cleanups or changes there. In those cases, there are changes. You have to, start using them for them to really have an effect. The final one, of course, is a block size increase. And, that ground has very much been poisoned for discussion, right? So it's a very difficult discussion to broach. The general feeling before the block size wars was that at some point we would want a block size increase of some sort of sane amount, gradual increase over time.
Yeah.
What that number is and everything else is a difficult decision to make that requires more data. But it became increasingly obvious that if we did that, people would just stop doing everything else that we need. So once we've crammed as much as we can into existing blocks, then it's time to have that conversation and say, okay, do we still think we need an increase? How much of an increase? Is there a reasonable number that's not zero? And maybe the number is zero. Maybe it's not worth changing because that would be most sane ways of doing that, at least, would be a hard fork, not a soft fork. So it would require, a hard fork in Bitcoin would require somewhere between 5 and 10 years, right? You'd have to design it, you have to ship it, then you have to give 5 years for everyone to upgrade, right? So you've got to get through the whole decision. Do we want to do it? And reach consensus that we do want to do it, and then implement it and make sure everybody's implemented it and we've got it tested and all those things. And then you go, okay, so from this version onwards, it'll be compatible with a new change. And then you give it it's got to be at least a couple of years. I'd say probably more like 5 would be happier for you. Okay, cool. And now it kicks in, right? It would be a huge, it would be an epic process at this stage. And it's only going to get harder as the community gets larger and more diverse. Making those kind of changes is going to get more difficult. And it may be that we never get such a change before it's decided that any change is too dangerous. That nobody can be trusted to make more changes. And we will stop changing. So I think those are the general kind of changes that I think about in Bitcoin.
All of these sound pretty much incremental and not so drastic. I'm surprised.
Well, I think block size increase is actually going to be, well, no, no, look, you know, so Bitcoin works. So this is the thing. If we ever fail to activate a change in Bitcoin, we still get Bitcoin, right? It doesn't go away. It has this really good failure mode for money anyway, is that if an upgrade fails, you've still got the old one, right? It doesn't stop working. right? You don't get your new shiny toy that you wanted.
It's not that easy. With a hard fork, it's much more complicated, right? You get two bitcoins, basically.
With a hard fork, it's all different. But the way we do soft forks, right?
Yeah.
It is very much that. If a soft fork fails to take off, then you're still got Bitcoin.
Yeah. The
hard fork is a whole other issue. If we were to do one, and there are people on both sides of the fence, some people who think we will never do a hard fork, other people who think we will do one eventually. Technically, we need to do one before about 2132, but that is
it's far enough, so we don't have to decide it. I hope
it's pretty non-controversial, though. So we have a 32-bit timestamp counted in seconds since 1970, and it will run out in 2132. And there's a very simple fix. You just go, okay, well, if it's above this number, it kind of wraps around, and you just keep going. But Bitcoin will stop if we don't fix that. So you've got a very clear, path forward. We know exactly what to do with it. We don't have a good alternative. It'll stop if you don't, so you better do it. And also, we could probably do that over 100 years, right? So the only people who will not successfully upgrade, people running 100-year software. That's, I think, for most people, quite an acceptable trade-off that we could perform. So that hard fork is almost in a class of its own, I think. If you wanted to say, okay, and at the same time in 2132, we're also going to have a block size increase, maybe. But again, I mean, I don't think you'd get anyone to do the work for that because none of us will be around to see it. So... I think I talk about a hard fork, I'm talking about something else, not just the time.
Like block size increase is much harder, because the problem is in a block size increase that you have to know how much, and everybody has a different position on that. Yeah, there's no number where 95% of everyone says, yeah, that's perfect. That's it.
Yeah, the only number we've got is the one that we've got at the moment, right? So that's an obvious choice. If you don't have a better choice, you stick with that, right? Hmm. So the only argument that I think I can make for having an increase is that decreasing is a soft fork, right?
Yeah.
So you have a hard cap, and you may not actually allow that hard cap because you've got a soft fork in that restricts it back down. And you can do weird stuff like, okay, for the next year, we're going to keep it this, and then we have to soft fork again, otherwise it goes back up. And, there is definitely a really good model in scaling Bitcoin in Hong Kong, but it was 2017, I think it was, talking about, you would have a hard limit that would be quite high, but you would incentivize miners to produce smaller blocks. And basically, if they wanted to produce a bigger block, they had to pay for the privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if they may produce a smaller block, they could take some of that money back out of the pot, if you say, right? And there's you can use various functions for that. But the idea is that if there's a lot of fee pressure, then a miner will logically make a bigger block because they're going to collect the fees, so it's worthwhile. But the pressure is against them. So if fees drop again, if people are not prepared to pay for it, blocks shrink. And so your average stays fairly small, although you've got some elastic block size, right? You can go up a little bit. It has all kinds of complications. The main one being that it doesn't work very well if there's still a significant block subsidy. You need to have most of your income coming from fees for that to work. Otherwise, you just produce a zero length block, take everything out of the pool, and get your 6.25 Bitcoin. Right? So it really does need to be further forward where most of the miner income is from fees, and then it becomes an incentive, right, at that point.
Does Ethereum have something like that? I'm not sure. Do they have a dynamic cap like that?
I have no idea. I think they have everything. They have like this kitchen sink approach, so they probably have seven.
Probably have everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to Honigdachs, the podcast which knows the least about Ethereum.
Yeah. So, I don't actually know very much about altcoins. Early on, I'm intellectually curious. I kind of looked at all these things, and it took me a while to realize there's a huge incentive problem with any altcoin. Is that if you wanted to produce an altcoin, even if you're like pure as snow, other people around you will jump on because they will want to, there's a huge opportunity there to print money. I mean, I often think that I kind of see Satoshi kind of presenting this idea of going, okay, let's proof of work and everything else. And in order to do it, we made this currency. And all people heard in the audience was, you can make your own currency? We should do that, right?
And
they
meme,
thought
right?
all the rest of it. And they ran with that one, right? You can make your own currency.
Make, make money. We can make money. There's this meme, right? You know this meme?
Yeah.
It's like, we can make better money for the whole world and we can make money. It's what it's all people hear.
Exactly. Exactly. So Bitcoin was trying to make a currency and everyone else is just trying to make money. Unfortunately, it's very close to the truth. I mean, there's probably some exceptions, but as a general rule, it means that I haven't spent my attention on just about anything else because I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's particularly interesting. Which brings us to one of the questions you raised beforehand, which is kind of how did I get into Blockstream, right? How did that path go?
Yeah.
So I was working at IBM on Linux, and I was kind of interested in this Bitcoin stuff. And, you know, I'd gotten Goxed and I'd played around with it a bit. And I was kind of interested in this scalability problem, right? So, and I was like, could we create a network that had less security that you traded off something, right? So you traded something off, but it was for petty cash. So it was okay. Like, you know, you'd move funds from Bitcoin onto this what we would now call a sidechain, but the Blockstream paper had not come out yet. You'd move on to this other thing, and I called it Pettycoin, and you would you'd spend it on there. And then, you know, if you built up too much money, whatever, you'd put that back on Bitcoin where it's safer, right? Where it's, that has all the Bitcoin guarantees, and Pettycoin could play a bit fast and loose because, you know, and get some scalability with the idea as a response. You could, you know, I toyed around with this for 5 months. I took a sabbatical. My wife was very supportive and said, yeah, no, that's cool. No, you can take a sabbatical and go play with this thing. So I did that. And right at the end of that, right at the end of my sabbatical, Blockstream dropped their sidechains paper. And I was like, this is what I was trying to build. Why didn't you publish this 6 months earlier? So they reached out to me and said, hey, we should really talk since you've been trying to build something very similar. And I finished my sabbatical. I went back to IBM as I had promised, and then about 6 months later, I ended up joining Blockstream. But during that process, the Lightning paper dropped, which is, you know, the second most exciting Bitcoin paper, a Bitcoin related paper I've ever read. And there's now a few interesting, really good Bitcoin paper related papers actually. But after Satoshi's paper itself, the sidechains paper was sidechain papers then dropped to third because the Lightning paper was even more exciting.
Yeah, I think so too.
And so I read the Lightning paper, and it was a mess. Like it it's a paper that described every tree, but never described the forest, right? And so the first time I read it, I couldn't understand it. And they'd done a presentation in San Francisco, and I wasn't there, obviously. And I jumped on Bitcoin Wizards, and I said, "Does anyone under?" And someone said, "I don't think all the details are in the paper. I think they, you know, just some stuff they were missing." Like, really, yeah. It seems like there's a lot in there. I should be able to. I read it again. I still didn't get it. And so finally, I went, okay, I'm going to take this seriously. And I sat down with a glass of wine and the paper, and I started taking notes, right? Just literally taking notes of everything.
You can do
that. Doing.
You can retake the papers with wine?
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, that's great. You should do it. So about halfway through that process, I realized what they were trying to do. Like I understood how the pieces fit together. And so I wrote a series of blog posts that was basically, here's the introduction that you need so that you can read the paper, right? And a lot of people actually ended up getting into Lightning through those blog posts. So I went across to this visit of Blockstream in Silicon Valley and kind of, you know, spent some time with them. And I had been brushing up on my C++, right? So because Bitcoin is written in C++, and I'm like, okay, so I'm going to have to, haven't used touch C++ for almost 10 years. It's been standardized since then and all that stuff. So I'm like, okay, practicing my C++, brushing it up. So really, I'm going to work on Bitcoin Core. I'm going to be the new kid in this experience project with these developers working on Bitcoin Core. It's going to be so cool. Like I'm going to be, you know, going from like being a senior experienced maintainer to being like the new kid. This was something I was actually rather looking forward to. It was going to be fun.
What year was that?
So this is, or it's like almost 6 years, over 6 years ago. So what we're talking like 2015, I think. It would have been early. Yes, early 2015. So that was the first Lightning paper. I didn't actually join Blockstream until May. So I was across in April talking to them and everything else. At the end of that time, Greg Maxwell, who was then CTO of Blockstream, said to me, "Oh, we've decided you should really implement the Lightning Network." Like go over there in a corner and you implement that instead. And I'm like, really? but I wanted to hang out with the cool kids, and you know, and but it was too good an opportunity, right? So Taj Draja and Joseph Poon had written this paper, and I'd chatted with them and I met them. I was across there, but they didn't have an intention of actually implementing it, right? They'd written the paper, you know. And Greg and I certainly felt that it was something that had to exist. Somebody had to actually do it, right? And make it work. And actually get some experience with it. This was important. This was useful. It had to exist. Somebody had to do it. So that's what I did. I started implementing it. And yeah, that was how I started the blockchain. So I actually wrote the first Lightning implementation. And then, yeah, we ended up having a meeting in Milan, I think 2016, because by then, Joseph and Taj had founded the company. It was Lightning Labs, you know, and we had ASIC in Paris as well, who had worked on the implementation. So we all went in to try to come up with a 1.0 standard, so we would all interoperate. I was one who typed up all the notes, so I guess I was chairing the meeting. And yeah, that became kind of the 1.0 spec. Eventually, we had more meetings. We still have meetings every 2 weeks to sort out spec issues between all the implementations and things. And yeah, that has been my life for the last 6 years, in fact.
It's come a long way, really.
Working on Lightning. Yeah, I mean, as an engineer, you always look at, oh, here's this thing we've got to do and this thing we've got to fix, and I really want to work on this and everything else. But you occasionally get a chance to look back. I had Bastian, T-Bast, who's a legendary coder from Async, send me an email from El Salvador, just kind of going, wow, we bought beers and dinner with Lightning. And it was just, you know, he said something like, you know, that I had said to him, occasionally you've got to kind of look behind you and realize how far you've come and not continually look at the mountains in front of you. And yeah, so he sent me this really great picture of them having beers in El Salvador. They just paid with Lightning and just realizing that moment that it was kind of real. That it wasn't just, you know, Christian sending me a testnet payment for cats, or, you know, someone in like room 77 getting, you know, a beer for test stats, right? This was real commerce, right? Kind of, people were actually using it. It's actually happening, right? For a long time, there were two fears. One is that they will all come at once, right? We won't be ready, and there'll be this huge adoption, and it will all just horribly crash and burn because we're not ready, and things aren't ready, and the software is not ready, and it's all terrible. You know, that massive like champagne problem of too much growth. But the other one is, what if we build it? And remember, think back like 3 years. We're building this stuff. We're trying this technology. What if we build it and they don't come?
Yeah. That looked very probable, like even
Bitcoin's a store of value. And sure. Yeah, and this whole Bitcoin as a payment thing is gone, right? That's not a thing, right? So when we started, like, Bitcoin was very much, you know, people thought of Bitcoin as a payment system. We recently used it as a payment system, and then fees have gotten too high and we realized we need to do something else. But the narrative changed. Yeah, and for a while there, it was like, why would you even bother with Lightning? Because that's not going to help digital gold. But we kept working at it because we're like, oh, I can't predict the future. I don't know what people are actually going to use. And it turns out it's pretty cool. So we still have this tension, right? Between why would you spend your sats and like, but it's fun to spend sats. And, you know, so yeah, I still don't know where it's going to go. But yeah.
So when I first, or in the beginning, when I heard about Lightning, I understood it like, yeah, it's some second level layer on top of Bitcoin, and this might work, or we'll have something else, or competing second layer solutions. But in the last 6 years, I didn't hear of any reasonable other solution for a second layer. So what do you think are we going? Will there be competing second layer, third layer?
So the simplest second layer is, you give me your money and I will, you know, and I will hold it for you and I'll sort it out and I will make, you know, payments that way. The Bitcoin bank model, which was very early in Bitcoin, this was an idea, right? There will be Bitcoin banks that will do these payments for you. Perhaps there'll be multi-sig banks or whatever, but, you know, there would be some custodian. That would be a second layer from some point of view. You know, we can do better, of course, and we have done better. You know, we look at Liquid as another layer two from Blockstream that has some different compromises and has some different features too. but that is not, you know, that is very much aimed at a specific solution, which is, you know, inter-exchange amounts and things like that. It has much more Bitcoin-like properties in that you don't have the same liquidity requirements that you do in Lightning. Lightning is a network, and it requires the network effects to even work, right? So, you know, there's no point just the three of us being on the network, particularly if one of us doesn't have any money, right? That's you know, you need liquidity in the network. You need to even make it work at all. And so that's kind of a disadvantage when you're small, but as it grows, it doesn't matter as much. So Lightning is a very different animal from Bitcoin, right? It's almost fundamental. A broadcast system like Bitcoin, you can come along later and figure out what happened, that the whole design of the system. So you don't, I can make a payment to you. In fact, I can make a payment to something that's offline, which is why it's so easy to get money into cold storage and so hard to get it out. You know, Lightning doesn't have that kind of property. Like Lightning, you have to have interaction in order to make payments, because at the end of the day, you're making a more direct payment with someone, right? So they have to be there talking to you. That's not a broadcast system, and that's how it scales. So we end up with this whole range of different properties than we have with Bitcoin. And so it has taken us a while to kind of get our heads around what that looks like. Are there other layer twos that are interesting? And I think, yes. But many of them are Lightning, will be Lightning attached. So you go back to the bank model. You go, huh, what if we have a shared kind of Galois kind of thing where we have some kind of multi-sig and you're holding the funds and, you know, and you use that as like a shared wallet in some way.
It's federated with multi-sig, cash now, right? That's something.
Yeah, or Chaumian eCash and things like that, yeah. Right? So that's where we're seeing some really interesting research, but at the end of the day, they'll all speak Lightning. Right? I don't know, maybe you call that layer 2.5 or layer 3. I think Lightning has reached the point where it's useful that you should just plug it into everything. Right? And I think that's the way we're going to go for it. And then we're going to argue about stupid number things. Like, I think that's a layer 4. sure.
Yeah, but that's also my impression, right? That Lightning is great for linking up these things, even custodial exchanges and custodial places. It's like, it just makes linking these things much easier and more trustless.
But that's also because we've reached a certain network size where it makes sense now, right? You join the Lightning network because that's where people are. Right. That was not true for the first 5 years of the Lightning network. Right. Absolutely. I think the Lightning network and the Lightning network can move faster than the Bitcoin network because we don't have this global consensus problem to the same extent. Right. As long as you can send payments to your peers, that's good. So we upgrade in parts. We don't have to all upgrade at once. We don't have to have this, you know, huge fork wars or other things. So we've got a lot more flexibility as far as making tweaks and making changes and things.
So is that true? Because now we have a lot some really big changes going on in the Lightning with Taproot, like the whole PTLC stuff and stuff. That's a big change. It has to be broken in many small chunks and stuff. And do you have the impression that this development model still works? That it's still possible to get your head around all these changes and to get I don't know, to decide who does what and when and stuff?
Yes, yes. And the reason is, fundamentally, we can throw away the old ones, right? Bitcoin can never do that. Bitcoin can never go, pay to pokey hash, we're going to obsolete them. They can't do that. They have to support that forever because, you know, you'll steal Satoshi's coins if you don't, right? Or pay to pokey. So whereas in Lightning, we can go, okay, well, we're going to sunset HTLCs and now PTLCs is a new thing. So sure, there's complexity in the meantime. For a couple of years, we support both. And if I want to pay you with a PTLC, I need to make sure every path supports PTLC. But your average, your kind of 90th percentile upgrade time for the Lightning network is somewhere between 6 to 9 months. So
wow, that's quick.
It's quite quick. Yeah. But it's because we have bugs, right? You really want to be upgrading there. Yeah, really stay on it, please. So yeah, CVEs come in, you want to upgrade. So people are, and we're still in that kind of early-ish phase, right? So people are upgrading because they want new features and everything else. So as a result, if we really wanted to, we could cut off old features quite fast. We've seen a few of that. You won't have noticed because, you know, nobody's on the Lightning network is that old that they will have, you know, fallen out. So, and if they do fall out, they just go on chain. Like you break channels with them, but it's not a disaster. You don't steal coins from anyone. Nobody loses money. They might fall off the Lightning Network, or they might stop getting payments to them because they don't support PTLCs for the new coolness. But yeah, from an engineering point of view, it is simpler because we can introduce a new thing and we can then go, okay, we no longer support the old thing. In future, there'll be nodes that require you to speak Taproot to fund channels. And I'll just be like, I'm not interested in that old stuff. Because it will be simpler.
It's not that simple, though. I mean, there's things that are very hard to do, like requiring people to change the structure of their channels. That would be impossible, basically, because people have millions of channels one day, and you can't all close them and reopen them, right?
No. So that's what splicing is for. So I've got an upgrade. So two things in the spec. So okay. And this is a useful aside, right? There's the spec process where we kind of agree how the changes should occur. Now anyone can do anything they want in their implementations, but fundamentally, if the spec tends to guide what implementations do, because then everyone will implement it and will interoperate. So there's this upgrade proposal that's in spec that's supported in experimental versions of C-Lightning, where you can upgrade your channels on the fly. It doesn't support respending, however. If you've got to have a new funding transaction, then we need something else, which is called splicing, which is also a draft of mine, a spec draft of mine, which I have not implemented yet. And that basically is a method to add or remove funds from a live channel. And you keep moving as you're doing it, right? So you can add funds, you on-chain top up or remove, and then you get a new funding transaction. And for a while, you do both in case, double spends or whatever. But at some point, it's buried enough that you just start using the new one. The new one could be a different style than the old one. So you can turn channels over that way. It would probably be a long time. So what I would expect is we will start with, you can't open new Taproot channels to me. Right? Well, we start with, we support both. And then you go, okay, from now on, you can't open a new channel. I'll support existing ones. I will not let you open a new channel, right? And then eventually you'll be like, we've got to splice, right? We have to actually do some on-chain transaction to change it because I do not want to support this crufty old code that we hate. But yeah, that process could take 5 years and different implementations will do it at different times. But with the growth of the Lightning Network, right, it's pretty easy to see that you might only have 3% of channels still on the old scheme. At that point, you go, well, maybe it's not worth the engineering effort, right?
Right. Again, there's a time where now it's still possible, right? But once we have like millions of channels, it's going to be harder.
Yeah, it will be harder, but it's still an individual decision, right? So you can still go, okay, well, I'm only going to take this kind of channel. And the network doesn't have to upgrade all at once. So you can do more experimentation, and that leads generally to faster progress. The experiment is losing their lunch, but usually faster progress, right? Yeah.
So there's different implementation of Lightning nodes or clients. How is the work with the other teams? Are you everyone has a red phone on their desk and you're in contact, or is it really like decentralized, independent implementations?
A bit of both. There's the spec process where we formally coordinate with each other. So somebody proposes a change to the specification. You have to have two independent implementations. So two teams need to implement it and both make sure they work together. And then it can be ratified in spec and it goes in spec and then everyone should implement it or can implement it if they want. But there's also red phones, right? I have the numbers of all the core developers if something goes horribly wrong. And we use that occasionally or sometimes for chat about stupid things that are going on. But usually it's for if there's something, something blows up or, someone finds a bug in one that may affect other implementations, which has happened multiple times where somebody's gone, oh, I made this mistake. I wonder if, L&D made the same mistake or Eclair made the same mistake. And, sometimes they have, right? So you should probably also fix this. And sometimes it's a security issue and sometimes it's just an annoyance. So all of those happen. The spec meetings are at 5:30 a.m. on Tuesday, every second Tuesday, Adelaide time, which means when my daylight saving time moves, it moves around for historical reasons, because I used to chair them and I refuse to get up any earlier than 5:30. So because I'm in a different hemisphere, my daylight saving time changes the opposite way to the northern hemisphere and at a different time. So there's always, 3 weeks of confusion twice a year as people turn up an hour early or an hour late. And but generally it works quite well. It used to be, it was originally a video call. It then went to an IRC meeting because if everyone's typing, it's a lot easier to log, right? You can just have you know, if you're not there, you can just read through everything that happened. But people really like the face-to-face meeting. So we kind of try to alternate now and do a face-to-face and then a video and then a face-to-face and a video, alternate. But it's not a very interesting meeting, right, to some extent. If you're not right in the weeds, it's like, okay, so let's talk about pull request, you know, 451. Like, okay, does anyone have any objections to this? Do we, you know, what do people think? Comment on the issue. Is it all good? Okay, we've improved that. Let's go in, right? You know, so that kind of thing, or, you know, that's the kind of level of stuff. It's very, very detailed and techie. But yeah, that's how we coordinate. And you know, I really like the other Lightning developers, right, from all the teams. We're all very focused on trying to make this thing as successful as possible, right? Everyone wants Lightning, and everyone wants this thing to work really well and work better. You know, the main problem is different teams have different priorities. So if you've got some feature you want, you've got to convince another team to implement it as well, so you can get it in the spec, right? So there's some horse trading. Okay, if you implement that, I'll implement this, right? So there's, you know, that keeps us all on our toes. But you know, a new L&D release comes out and it's got some cool new feature, and I'm like, oh crap. Now we've got to implement that, you know, and then a Clary comes out and they've got some cool new thing. And like, oh man, we really have to implement that. You know, it is definitely keeping me on a treadmill, right? It keeps everyone very much on their toes. The Sea Lightning team for a long time was probably the smallest team. There are only three of us at Blockstream. But we're now up to five. We've brought on a couple of new people, but, you know, and we're taking on a couple more as well on my team. But, you know, a lot of the stuff is, you know, it's an open source project. So we get a lot of external contributions and people just, you know, they're hacking on stuff. They've got their C Lightning node and they want to make something better. And so they contribute and add things, a lot of plugins and stuff written by third parties. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a whole ecosystem out there that we get to ride on as well. But for me and for us, the spec process is at the end of the day more important than the code that we write. It's easy to rewrite code, but the spec is really hard to fix. It can be done, but you know, if we screw that up, then all the implementation needs to change, right? Bugs in the spec have a much deeper effect than a bug in one implementation that we can just patch and move on. So we are the most spec-driven of things because that's the kind of Blockstream priority. From Blockstream point of view, our original justification for working on the Lightning Network was that it has to exist.
That's what I wanted to ask. So why does Blockstream do it? Is it because they secretly profit from it?
I wish. So I felt a lot nervous for a long time about asking for resources for to work on Lightning, right? Because, you know, there are vague things. I mean, if you use Lightning to atomic swap into Liquid or something, Handwave, you know, there could be all these possibilities, but there wasn't an obvious path to monetization, right? So why are they paying my bills? And a lot of it was this idea that we do need this to exist, right? This makes Bitcoin better. And the original Liquid paper had this idea of like atomic swaps. And it's like, well, Lightning's an atomic swap. We could just, if there's a Lightning network, it would be easy to atomic swap in and out if we wanted to. So that's kind of like, okay, so there's a defensible reason, right? Where if this thing's existing and flourishing, it would be cool because we could connect the two together. So there's kind of like a believable reason to ask for money. You know, more recently, we've kind of moved more into, okay, we should look at what products can we build. And that's what the Greenlight project, which Christian spearheaded and came up with, this idea that we could run the infrastructure for you, but you would hold the keys. And that for us is really important. It's one of the Blockstream things, like we don't want custody of your funds. It's bad for you and it's bad for us. Like it's all bad. Don't do that, right? So we finally figured out how to do this in a way that, you know, would allow you to hold things, but we would do some of the hosting for you, and we could put nodes in the front end that we could do some management and everything else, which would be kind of cool. And a nice halfway house. So this is one of the cool things about Lightning. Okay, just to geek out a bit. You remember when everyone was trying to convince people to accept Bitcoin, and what they did is they went to like BitPay or something and they plugged in Bitcoin and they never had to touch any Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. Lightning's not quite like that, because if you run a Lightning node, you need to have some Bitcoin, right? You need some liquidity, right? And business people understand this because they're used to cash registers that need to have a float, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to have a certain amount of cash in the cash register at the beginning of the day so you can give people change. It is very analogous to running a Lightning node. So you can't run a Lightning node and not touch Bitcoin. And so even if you don't care about Bitcoin, if you want to get on the Lightning network to do your Bitcoin thing, you're going to have some of it anyway. Even if you immediately push most of it off to an exchange and convert it to, you know, whatever you want, you're still holding some amount of Bitcoin, right?
So, well, or someone does it for you. I mean, you can have someone else do it for you.
Yeah, and I mean, that to some extent was always true. But I think there's a nice halfway house here where, you know, you can run your own infrastructure and you will actually have, you know, you have a reason that you have to hold some Bitcoin. And you're a lot further in the door than you were with just some like sign up to BitPay kind of thing, right? And that to me is kind of interesting because I think that allows places to accept Bitcoin and they'll naturally be holding a little bit of Bitcoin and then maybe they become interested. Maybe they're like, well, you know, hey, this person wants to be paid in Bitcoin. Well, let's rather than just turning it all into cash, let's keep some amount around so we can make more payments. And, you know, it does feed more directly into kind of this circular Bitcoin economy idea. And it grows the network. Anything that grows the Lightning Network at this point is good, right? So so I really love this idea that people will jump on and do things. So it's like, okay, people want the convenience of hosting, but how can we do this in a way that they can, that we can provide the hosting for them and take some of the pain out, but not have custody, right? Have them have the keys and have them the ability as they grow. And hopefully we have a pricing model which makes it increasingly uncomfortable for them to stay on our platform and they can go off and host their own things. They just take their keys and nobody really notices their IP address changes. But they keep all their channels or whatever else. That's our vision for how to help the Lightning Network and make it grow. And we might even make some money. I'm not a business person and I can never tell what's going to make money, but you know, it's certainly believable, right? So so I think that was a bit of a sigh of relief when Christian came out. I was like, wow, that sounds like a not insane business plan. And not insane is all you require for VC funded companies, right? So
that's true.
So yeah.
All right. That's great to hear.
Yeah, I like that proposal.
Yeah, I mean, I find that all these halfway models, there are quite a lot of them on the Lightning Network. Like if you look at what Assange does with Phoenix, it's very similar. It's like you have a Lightning node running, but it doesn't do anything. It's like Assange does all that for you, and they take a cut, and that's great. I mean, it's a great model. I mean, there's lots of models that shift these boundaries a little bit, and it's probably great if they all exist.
Yeah, to be fair though, Async have been really pushing this idea because so they are uncomfortable with the amount of information that they learn. Because you're an end node, right? And you push through them, and the way it works is you say to them, oh, please route this to Joe over here. How do I get to Joe? Why? Oh, I'm just asking. No, really. By the way, here's a payment. You have no idea where it's going, right? They're not comfortable with this model, right? So they've been pioneering a lot of the blinded path work. It was Async. The trampoline routing. And all of this idea that they can get away from this model where they have to be the supplier of routes. Because they found the problem of, you know, the problem is that the people open their app to make a payment. And you don't have time to sync the entire network before, you know, they want to make a payment now, right? They don't want to make it in a few minutes. So because it's not always on, you have this tension here between usability and this idea that every node should have enough for the network. It doesn't have to ask anyone for directions. So so they've worked really hard on the spec process and on their implementation to make this work. So, you know, they are very much pushing as much sovereignty down to the individual as they can, which I think is fantastic. And yeah, look, their business model of like charging you an amount, like if you make one of my wallets is Phoenix Wallet. It's great for interop testing. And, you know, I really like it. Like I made an on-chain payment to someone because Tonga, I think, didn't have Lightning. And so I did an on-chain payment. And they tell you, we're going to charge you this many sats. And I'm sure.
Fine.
That's a perfectly viable business model. And it's still really cheap, right? So great.
Yeah, it's amazing that all this innovation is possible in this space, and that everybody can just try their own models and see what sticks. I really like that.
Yeah, and we're still early, and we still don't know what we're doing. So, you know, that's true. Just keep hitting the keys until something happens, right? that's great.
All right. So what are you excited about in the Lightning development? What are you doing at the moment?
Okay, so I really like this idea of Bolt 12. So this idea that we need a higher level for payments. So when I wrote Bolt 11, we just needed something to, you know, to encode a payment in some way. So you could say, okay, cool, pay me some money. That's fine as far as it goes, but we deserve more than that. And we really want, we want recurring payments. We want a static payment, right? So we want this, a single thing that you can scan and it will pay that. But we also want, a more ambitious things. We want, a recurring payment. So pay me five USD a month or something and have your wallet handle that process transparently. We want the reverse case, right? So at the moment, I can pay bit refill using Bolt 11 because it's nice and anonymous and we've got all this onion routing and everything else. Should something go wrong and have to issue me a refund? Well, now it's not anonymous anymore. I have to dox myself in order to get my money back, right? So that's a problem. That's a really bad problem to have. So we want to have, and one of the original design decisions of the Light Network was that you have payer privacy. The person paying is private, but the vendor or the person receiving the money isn't private. But there are many perfectly valid cases, particularly the refund case is the obvious one, but other cases where you're paying a friend where you don't want to reveal all the information about this. So there's a lot of stuff being worked on around that. That's all in Bolt 12. Proposal that uses blended routes and uses this great stuff. At the moment, we use LNURL for some of this stuff, but that involves a web request, and that sort of also just throws away most of your privacy at that point in practice. So, and also requires you to run a web server on things and have a, these days, a web server can't just be a random IP address. It has to be, people want, you know, HTTPS, of course, they want encryption, and that requires them to have a domain name that's registered somewhere. So we have this Light Network. So tunneling requests over the Light Network is a fairly straightforward innovation, and we already have this onion routing and everything else. So this all goes into Bolt 12. It's a pretty big step forward, which means it's a significant amount of engineering. So there are a number of people working on that at the moment. C-Lightning supported it for a while because I'm not smart enough to write a spec without actually trying it, right? I changed a number of things. I've changed the spec at least three times. In fact, bolt12.org has a very clear warning not to get the QR code tattooed on yourself yet, because it can change. It can change, right? Again, you can't ratify it in the spec until two interoperable implementations have completed it. So until the second one comes along and we...
But there hasn't been that yet.
No. So so Eclair are working on it. And doing some great work on that. They've got onion messages working and doing the higher level Bolt 12 stuff. We dropped the recurrence requirement for them because that was a significant part of that spec. And so we will add that again later. But it's not just a formality, right? Somebody else who comes along with fresh eyes and reads it and tries to implement it. Sometimes they just fix the spec. They say, oh, you didn't say it this way. Otherwise, they go, why are you doing it this way? This is stupid. Why don't we just do it this way? And that happens all the time. Right? Yeah. And you know, you have a good reason. Oh, because originally I was thinking this, but then we ended up doing that. So now it is, you're right, it's stupid. So we do often get changes when the second implementer comes along and goes, huh, wait, this doesn't make sense. Why would we do it that way? Why not just do it this way? And things like that. So it could well change at least once more before it's final. Which is annoying because there are people out there trying to use it today, but they have been warned that being a pioneer is difficult. That's part of the fun. So I'm excited about. I think I'm excited about all the things that people are using Lightning for that I hadn't considered. Podcasting, right? Some of the podcasting Lightning integration is really interesting. And you know, a number of those higher
layers. Still not done it. We have to think. We have to do that.
You should figure it's apparently quite easy to do. You just need to put some stuff in RSS feed and it kind of, you know, a few things and it works. So I've heard really good things, and I should probably figure out how to do it so that I can just play with it. But you know, a lot of people that is the level of exploring. So I mean, I'm down here in the weeds, kind of looking at the integration between like Bitcoin and Lightning and how packets flow in the wire and everything else. There's this whole infinite stack of people doing stuff above who use words I don't understand. at the end of the day, they're the people that people interact with, right? They're go, you know, hey, they're you know, they're doing stuff with podcasts or whatever else they are doing. And they're the ones kind of, you know, that actually, they're the tip of the iceberg, right? They make stuff happen, right? I just build the tools so that they can do interesting and cool stuff. So I expect increasingly a lot of the cool stuff will happen up there, and nobody will know who I am, which is kind of, you know, the Linux story, right? I mean, who knows who the Linux coders are except other coders, and they're already one step away from the actual users, right? So I'm used to this role where you're a coder for other coders, and so nobody knows who you are.
You still have a Wikipedia entry. I mean, pretty
yeah, good. that's true. Although not so much for my Lightning stuff. That's
true. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day.
Needs to be updated. But there's a call to action here.
Yes. yes. So, you know, this is a pretty comfortable role for me, right? I've always produced stuff that other people have taken and done great things with. And that's pretty cool, right? Because the thing is, those people who do great things, they know who you are, and they'll, like, you know, maybe lend you the Ferrari on weekends, or, you know, at least buy you a beer when they see you at a conference, right? So, yeah, that's that permissionless innovation, the fact that people take stuff and they go and do things with it without having to ask. Because sometimes, a lot of the time, they don't even know if it'll work, right? They're like, I have this idea. I don't know if it's dumb or brilliant, right? All of us have those ideas. Mine are mainly dumb. But other people, you know, if they had to ask permission, they wouldn't ask. They'd be almost too embarrassed, right? And if they go and do it and it fails, they just, you know, no one ever hears about it, and it's fine. But sometimes it succeeds, and then, you know, I get to take some credit, right? Oh yeah, well, I you know, I built the stuff that he built, that, you know, that great thing on top of that you use. Yeah, that's all me. It's all me. Yeah. So
that's a good position to be in.
So, that's my plan. Yes.
Yeah, I like your frame. So do you see any challenges for the Lightning Network? Do you see anything that could go wrong still?
Oh, wow. Yeah. What could go wrong? Okay. So it's still too easy to denial of service the Lightning Network. And that has been a topic of discussion for over 6 years. You know, it's never a priority until suddenly one day it will be. But robustness and privacy are the two things that I think I worry about. Robustness from the point of view of, you know, just the difficulty of a single actor to take down significant parts of the network is important and something we need to work on more. It becomes more difficult as the network gets larger, but it's still a concern. The other thing, though, is privacy. And privacy is kind of invisible until it's not. So for me and for the other Lightning developers, privacy was a key issue. That's why, even though, you know, in the first version, we probably could have gone away with much less privacy features than we have, but we all felt that it was important. And we also knew that if we didn't put it in the first version, there'd always be excuses not to. You know, there are other things more important than everything else, because privacy isn't, you know, until it suddenly is, right? It's not, it's not a killer distinguishing feature. So more privacy is something that's being continually worked on, and I think that's important that work continue. And, you know, excuse me, I expect to see more adversarial research from people trying to break Lightning privacy and attacking it. And there's definitely things that we could do much better. And some users will be more privacy aware than others. And will, as long as fees are low, we can move the needle significantly with the defaults. So if you're paying, the difference between like paying 0.1%, 0.15% fees, nobody cares. So you push the defaults to 0.15% and you get a little bit, if that gives you significantly more privacy, that's what you do. And the users who really, 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 really want to save that, you know, 0.5% or something, they're prepared to go in and tweak the settings so that they have less privacy for that, because they're always going to make direct payments and they're never going to, you know, choose a slightly more obscure route. That's great. But as long as the majority do, we all benefit, right? So I'm hoping to keep the trade-off down that end where nobody cares, right? We give you enough privacy at a cheap enough price that nobody even thinks to go in and try to save a few microsats, right?
Yeah, from Bitcoin, it seems much, much, much more difficult to re-implement privacy now after it's in that state. So yep, that's one of the big hopes for second layer and Lightning.
Yeah, absolutely. And just from a fundamental point of view, because you're not a broadcast network, you're not telling everyone about everything. You're already kind of ahead. There are other things you need to do, of course, but that by itself means there isn't a permanent record of everything that's gone on. So in some ways, yeah, we're always going to have a little bit of an advantage.
Yeah, but it's also a much more complex system. So there's a lot of things where you can incidentally lose some privacy, and it's hard. I mean, it's easy to overlook. Like, I mean, there's so many places where you can attack privacy in the Lightning Network, mm-hmm. and we are just only starting to find out about these and how much the impact is of these and how much they are used.
Yes. So the crossover, particularly between on-chain and off-chain Lightning, is interesting. That's my fault too. I came up with the gossip system that we use, and it seemed like a good idea. We all have this shared state. We all know this blockchain. So surely we can just refer to those, and we can prove that we control these UTXOs. And well, that was kind of clever, except for the fact that leaking just that, even though at the time that's not information. If you later on go suspend those funds and everything else, you've doxed yourself. You open a private channel or an undisclosed channel later, they can tell because you said that was your UTXO before, and it's pretty obvious unless you do some mixing. So, you know, those kind of things are things that we would like to, you know, to fix in the Lightning Network, preferably before they're used against us.
Oh, do you have any ideas how to do that?
Oh yeah, lots. So at the moment, the reason. Okay, so the reason I prove that I own a channel with you, right? So I advertise a channel, I have to prove that I own it or we own it. There's a two of two and everything else. Yeah. And the reason that we make me prove it is because otherwise I can spam the Lightning Network, right? We use Bitcoin as a cheap anti-spam, right? But what if I just, and you can't announce your node until you've got some channels. So to announce a channel, you've got to prove you own a transaction. So you've got to have a UTXO. Then you can announce a channel, and then you can announce a node. Well, we could kind of loosen the constraints a little bit. Of course, we could use zero knowledge proofs or something to prove something that without telling you anything. But that's perhaps a bit more exotic. And then, you know, there's people talking about that. But we can also invert things and say, cool, okay, you can announce a node as long as you prove you own any UTXO. Just prove you own a UTXO, call it. That's your ticket, right? Then you can announce a node. And, you know, you can announce, if you prove that you own like a million sats, then you can announce a million sats worth of channels, right? Maybe some limit, right? You can't announce a million one sat channels, but, you know, you can come up with some heuristics, right? Okay, you can announce, you know, minimum size this, and you can announce, you know, and we'll just believe you. So, or maybe you can announce 10 million, so you give a factor of 10. So you still have to have some proof, but not proof. Now, the UTXO I've proved might not even be mine. I may have convinced someone else to rent me the UTXO, just sign my message for me using their keys, and I use that as my broadcast, right? So it's not. So we've already moved the proof apart, right? But even if it is one of mine, that might be one of my channels. It doesn't tell you about anything the other channels, right? It doesn't tell you which channel it is. So even if it is my Lightning node, it is one of my channels. You know, and because remember, with Taproot, they're all going to look the same anyway. Mm-hmm. So I just throw a UTXO out there, and I get to advertise some channels, and now that linkage is broken. But we still get kind of anti-spam properties. You can't just go out and advertise a billion channels. So that would be one way of doing it. And because we need to change the gossip network for Taproot, because as I said, we literally prove that this is a two of two payment to these two keys and everything else. Well, with Taproot, it's going to look like a single payment and everything else. So we'll need to redo that anyway. So, okay, well, if we're there, maybe we do this as well, right? And screw over those chain analysis people who are being annoying. So, so that's definitely a win. So those discussions are kind of ongoing.
That sounds exciting.
And we could do both. We have the old system and the new system. And, you know, for the moment, you support both. And then eventually, again, you go, okay, it's been a few years now. The old system's going away. And, you can measure it. It's easy. You go, well, 95% of the network is on the new system. We can just throw away the old ones and, you know, you'll have to re-announce your channels. Upgrade your software. It's been 2 years. Upgrade your software. So if you don't upgrade it, we've probably got enough bugs by that point that we can steal your funds anyway. So there are definitely ways we can improve all these things, right? And this is what when I talk about wanting to attract more brilliant people, some, you know, in that case, that suggestion was mine, but you know, inspired by other people who've done some fantastic work and come up with things that I had never thought of. I'm always excited to have people thinking about all this stuff.
Cool. Amazing.
You're doing quite good advertising for being a developer, actually.
Yes. Developers are cool. It is so much fun. It is so fun, right? I am not a morning person, but I get up at 5:30 in the morning, you know, every Tuesday to work on this stuff, right? And that's the one thing that will make me retire. Is like I will Monday morning I will go, no, I'm going to sleep in forever. I'm just going to sleep in from now on. That's it. I'm giving up being a Lightning developer, but it's too exciting, right? It's too cool. We get to work on all this fun stuff, and we don't know the answers, right? A lot of this is still very, it's early days, right? People come in and bright people come in with like new ideas and new things. We go, that is amazing. That's fantastic. Or yeah, that's a great idea, but it doesn't work for these reasons. But you know, often then they'll come along, and they'll fix it, right? And they'll be like, oh, okay, now we have to do that because that's great. I love working with that. Most of the developers are younger than I am. So it definitely keeps me on my toes to try to keep up with all the stuff that they're talking about. Otherwise, I just stroke my beard and nod.
That's what I do.
Yeah. Interesting. Yes.
It's very, very motivating, I think. Yeah, you heard it here. You have to become a Lightning developer or a Bitcoin developer. Yeah, if you feel the calling in you.
Yes.
That's one more thing that I have to know actually. Because one thing I really admire about you is that you have been really critical of your employer as well. I mean, you have been for example, I've pointed out that on the Blockstream mining node that the whole renewable story is kind of I don't know, it's a hoax. It's they claim one thing and it's something completely different. And I noticed that you liked that tweet and went publicly. and just lately, I've seen you wear some interesting Tether T-shirts, like they say, don't verify trust, right? And that's great. I mean, I love that. But there are some questions that arise in me whenever I hear that. It's like first, but wow, how do they let you do that? Aren't you afraid to lose your job?
So actually, that's a very good question. I do it because, of course, I have a huge amount of respect for everyone who works at Blockstream, and I hold us to incredibly high standards, both publicly and privately, right? So. When you set up a company and you take money and you're trying to make things work, you have to make compromises inevitably, like technical compromises, engineering compromises, right? You know, you want to make things perfect, but you know, you have to ship at some point. And you know, that's always going to be a tension, right? Engineers are always going to be, no, it's not ready. It's not perfect. We haven't done it right. And the business people are always going to be like, no, you know, the customer wants a unicorn now, just shove the horse out the door and that's it, right? Yeah. So there's always going to be this tension is healthy, right? This is a really healthy tension. Different people come with different priorities and they should have this discussion of views, right? So from our point of view, it's never good enough. But from their point of view, it's too slow, right? We need to get it out now. And that's what drives things forward, right? Because the truth is often somewhere in the middle. And both can be true, right? Both can be true. It can be that, you know, engineering are not happy, and you know, and the customer facing people are not happy either, right? You know, that like they want one thing, we want something else, and all these things. So and often some of the most creative solutions come out of that when they go, oh, you know, the customer wants a unicorn that can fly, and they're like, well, you can, you know, how about a pig and lots of thrust, right? We can just put a rocket engine on a pig and stick a horn on it, right? Yeah, you know, I mean, what do they really want, you know? And the understanding of what you can do. And so there's very much an engineering culture inside Blockstream. And also I am sometimes amazed with what the research people come up with, things I didn't think was possible, right? So I look at things like SegWit originally, Peter, that came out of the idea that SegWit could be done as a software work was Luke Jr.'s work, right? So, you know, when you've got these brilliant minds working on things, they sometimes come up with things that you didn't know could be done. I'm thinking of Bech32, right? So Peter Willer, when he was working, still working at Blockstream, came up with the Bech32 encoding, and he and Greg Maxwell and a couple of others came up with this encoding such that, you know, you could catch up to 5 errors in it. And guarantee that you would catch it, right? I didn't know that that was possible. And then some of the insane things they did to try to make sure that common errors, you catch up to 6 and stuff like this. You know, just some amazing things that... So if you come in with requirements and you kind of, you know, press your engineers really hard, sometimes you get diamonds, right? So that's part of my job. Part of my job is to hold us to very high standards and to insist that we do things better. Privately and publicly, and that's very much the culture inside Blockstream. That, you know, we should, is particularly in an industry where standards are variable, right? There is a lot of tolerance for stuff that I don't accept personally as an engineer, right? I'm just like, no, you should not be doing that. I don't care. That's the industry norm. That's terrible, and let's not do that, right? So. You know, and different people have different tolerances, but certainly I feel that we can and need to do better. So that often comes out. The Tether thing is interesting. I mean, Adam's got on the record defending Tether a lot. I think Tether is high risk, and I think it's hard to quantify risk, which worries me. You know, Adam makes a very valid point to that Tether has more transparency than the vast majority of exchanges. In fact, all exchanges. Now that's, to me, that's horrifying and says terrible things about exchanges, right? But it's also true, right? To be fair. So, you know, you can kind of slice this different ways. I think that says something about how the whole industry needs to do better. But, you know, if you had to choose between keeping your funds in Binance, keeping your funds in Tether, I'd pick Tether, right? You know, so, you know, but, you know, we're talking about, both things that are definitely uncomfortable risk profiles for me. So yeah, so this is an ongoing conversation that has happened. So, you know, I think it is important for us to have honest and frank discussions about things. You know, we look at Bitcoin as sort of the Bitcoin isn't perfect, but it is definitely a level to which we should aim, right? And so, you know, we look at something like Liquid and we go, okay, are we comfortable with the security of Liquid? No, I'm not. I'm not comfortable with the security of Bitcoin, right? So, you know, it is important that you have high standards and you're continually thinking, how do we make it more secure, right? So the whole confidential assets, which was, you know, confidential transactions, now it's confidential assets, the fact that you can't tell what's going on in the network has two purposes. One is to obscure things on the network so that, you know, front running and stuff like that. But it's also to protect you from the miners. In this case, who are the Federation, right? They can't censor things they can't see.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Hmm. So that's designed in there to prevent the problem that we've got this Federation of miners who can control and can censor things, right? So how do you prevent that? Well, you put in all this complicated zero knowledge mathematics in order to get, see, you know. So this is the kind of thing that blockchain engineers think about, right? And so you know, what do we worry about? The Federation don't necessarily trust each other, right? And we don't actually want them to become too cozy either, right? You kind of want them all distributed and everything else. So that's why they all communicate over Tor. You know, a lot of really hard thought went into this, these problems of how do we minimize trust across the system and how do we increase verifiability so that you can verify as much as you can and trust as little as possible. And we're always looking for ways, can we reduce it further, right? Engineering is always like, have we just introduced a trust point? Can we reduce that somehow? Can we increase the verifiability? And that's just the boxing way of looking at anything. Sometimes the answer is we don't know how to do it better. It's never a comfortable answer, but sometimes we don't know how to do it better. Sometimes the answer is, frankly, yes, we could, but no one cares, right? At the end of the day, you have to sell it, right? And if this brings us back to the Tether problem, right? Tether is damn useful, right? And they've done enough to gain trust that, you know, I wish the industry had higher standards, right? I really wish we did. I wish all the exchanges published regular proof of reserves, ideally at semi-randomized intervals, you know, when a block hits a certain, like, hash prefix or something. They all had to publish proof of reserves, and you know, we'd do all this amazing stuff. That would be awesome. I would love that. We're so far from that. We live in this very imperfect world. So that makes me grumpy sometimes. So as a Blockstream engineer, I have a duty to point this out. Okay, no, we can do better. We need to do better. Everyone should do better. And that's shared within the company. Although it's frustrating, right? It's always like, yeah, look, hey, Rusty, just calm down, dude, right? We're doing enough already, right? We can't do everything. And I think that's a valid criticism too. But, again, that tension often leads to a creative process by which, you know, people conflict and they come to an increased understanding of the other person's viewpoint, but also potentially come up with some more lateral and outside solutions that you can apply to these things. So it is actually a very fun place to work, as you can probably tell. But it can seem very chaotic from the outside. And so I think that confuses people a little bit. But Adam and I actually had a long chat a couple of days ago on these kind of issues. And it was really interesting he was very nuanced on his position on Tether and where he sees it sit in the industry perspective, whereas I'm looking at it purely from an engineering perspective. So, So I don't think I'm fired. Although I don't know, maybe when he hears this podcast, I'll get a surprise.
It's kind of a Warren Canary if they fire.
That's right.
All right. I just thought about if you're critical of Tether, what do you think about the El Salvador notes? The bond. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So, So is the perfect the enemy of the good here? Right. So this is a really hard question, right? So if you're going to issue a bond and you issue on liquid, we do get some things that is an improvement over the legacy system. So, I'll buy that. There are a lot of due diligence questions I would want to know about the bond, like who's actually holding the keys? Mm. That's kind of important. Yeah. Where is the Bitcoin? What does default look like? All these kind of things, right? You know, there are a lot of good, hard questions that investors should be asking. On the other hand, the fact that we're even discussing a sovereign bond in the Bitcoin space is just, I'm just not ready for that, man. I'm just not ready. Right? I'm still hacking away on my keyboard. I don't really. There are all these interesting questions that are more in the finance end than my end. But if nothing else, if we have some bonds and other things, Blockstream mining node or whatever it is, trading on liquid, you do get some really nice properties. The confidential assets thing prevents a whole pile of front running and other information leaking out, which is kind of cool. And it gives you, it does give you some limited privacy because, there are exchanges involved and everything else. But the ability to atomic swap stuff opens some whole new weird opportunities, which I think is really kind of interesting. I am particularly interested in the idea of, so Jack Mallers really opened my eyes to this, that if the Lightning Network only transports Bitcoin, you can swap it at the edges, right? Now he does it mechanically with banking relationships and everything else is general, but theoretically we could swap in and out of liquid. We could have nodes where, hey, I will swap this asset on liquid or whatever for this rate. And you send it and it either happens or doesn't. It's an atomic swap, right? You will either get the...
You have this American option problem though, right? It means like, because you can always decide to not take it if the price goes down or something.
And you have to take into account your timing and other issues, right? You need a tight time window to make that work. But maybe it's more possible because liquid has 1 minute blocks, right? You can constrain your problem a little bit and your block numbers. You haven't got a variable length. So there are some cute things and no one can tell it's happening, right? And that's kind of cool. It's actually terrible from a liquid marketing point of view. Like if everyone was doing it, we wouldn't be able to tell anyone, like we could guess. So actually in some ways, like you should never launch a product that has this much privacy because it's really bad for marketing. But from a geek point of view, and from an excitement point of view, and from a financial privacy point of view, it has some interesting things in it, right? And some things that the existing markets really don't cater for at all. So even if you take an existing market and you move it across here, now when you also take the fact that there's this weird Bitcoin thing and you're devil's in the details, we need to see all the details of how this is going to work, but it's kind of cool. And you know, I'm going to have to learn Spanish is the answer, really. I'm just going to have to learn Spanish and visit El Salvador and, you know, and try to figure out.
I highly recommend. It's beautiful. It's a great place.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, and I don't know. And then there, of course, the Bitcoin bond comes with like this opportunity to like get citizenship or whatever, like residence and things, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's a thing that there's a different axis on the risk profile. I don't even know where that sits. Right. But again, I'm just still sitting here going, wait, I can't believe we're discussing a sovereign bond and Bitcoin in the same place, right? So it's way off left field for me.
All right. Manuel, do you have any remaining questions?
No, but I think I'll re-listen to this podcast with a glass of wine and then I understand this.
That's the problem. Eh? It's still early in the morning here. We don't have any wine. But you don't drink any wine.
I had a beer. I had a good German beer before good. I came on. So that's good.
It's very, very fitting. All right. I think we're already probably about 2 hours long. So we should wrap this up. It was so fascinating to hear from you. And so many great new inputs. Amazing. I'm really grateful that you took the time, and I hope this whole recording thing works out and we can enlighten everybody.
Thank you. You can cut out the boring bits and just, you know, work it down to 30 minutes and it'll be great.
I don't remember any.
Yeah. I had a heap of fun, and I'm glad that I kind of, this stuff is exciting, right? And it's exciting on so many levels. Like technically it's exciting. There's people who care now. Like it's not just this tiny project of like, my mom and me and, you know, and three other guys I met on the internet going, yeah, this is exciting, right? This is actually exciting. Like there's all this stuff happening. And, you know, it's hard to keep up, you know, just with all this, the breadth of stuff happening. And that is sort of an amazing feeling. And I remember this the early days of Linux when suddenly like it became a thing people were interested in and talking about and doing. And like, you know, I remember there was a big Linux expo in 1999. And one of the old timers said to me, it's like all these hippies when they finally legalized marijuana, right? And there's Philip Morris and everyone offering you dope and, you know, here you go, try this and everything else. And they're just wandering around this huge display is going, whoa. This is amazing. And it was like, wow, the mainstream has arrived and they're here and it's weird. And Bitcoin's going through this transition now, right? Of like, it's becoming real. And, true. You know, it's still very early, but it is not just, you know, it's not just this insane hobby project anymore. And so it's got this amazing dynamism and, you know, it makes me get up early in the morning to continue to talk about it and do stuff. So,
yeah, cool. I sometimes find that scary that it's getting so real, but it's great that you reminded us that it's also very, very exciting.
It is so much fun. And yeah, it was great talking with you both. Thank you very much for having me on. And I hope that I conveyed some of the excitement that I have over this stuff. And yeah. We should do it again. We could probably go for another 2 hours.
Yeah, next time. Yeah. Very happily.
Let's see if there's any changes to be discussed in the future.
All right.
And yeah, it's nice to see that you're so excited, even though you're so long in the space, and your excitement definitely is contagious. But yeah, that was nice. Thank you.
Okay, there's one thing that Manuel always needs to say at the end of every episode.
One thing is important.
One thing is important.
See you later, and verschlüsselt eure Backups.
So, did you get that?
Verschlüsselt key, like check, mm-hmm. Verify.
That's encrypt your backups.
Encrypt your backups. Verschlüsselt key. Okay, of course. Okay, encrypt your backups. Thank you. I'll go do that now.
All right. All right. Thank you.